Hey there, today I'll be talking with a guest who shares his personal experience of re-examining the faith he learned from his fundamentalist upbringing. And he shares what it was like to hear earth-shattering family secrets by listening to a podcast. You're going to love today's episode. I'm Amy Fritz, and you're listening to the Untangled Faith Podcast, a podcast for anyone who has found themselves confused or disillusioned in their faith journey. If you want to hold on to your faith while untangling it from all that is not good or true, this is the place for you. Just recently, I sat down with today's guest, and he shared about what it was like to grow up in an independent fundamentalist Baptist church, an IFB church, and how he discovered the real Jesus, in part through the influence of his wife. He also talks about what it was like to reckon with the fact that his father was a serial abuser. This conversation covers some sensitive topics, so I want to give you a warning at the outset so you can best take care of yourself and those around you who may be listening. Here's my conversation with Ryan George. Welcome to the Untangled Faith Podcast. Ryan, I actually saw your book posted on somebody else's Facebook.
Okay.
Before, and I was like, how do I get that book? And how am I going to talk to this person?
Okay.
I was happy to get it. And honestly, I started underlining more than wasn't underlined.
No way.
Even in the first chapters. So, yeah. So, you know, a little bit, like my listeners have seen some things. Mm. They have experienced some hard things with their faith, but they're still here. And I think they're going to resonate with your story. Yeah. So I want to start out with asking you, this last year, the world has been invited into the conversation, into the world of the independent fundamental Baptist movement denomination. I don't know that it's a denomination.
It's a subset of a subset of a, maybe another subset of a denomination. Yeah.
Right. With the wildly popular Shiny Happy People docuseries, people have seen a little glimpse of that. Lots of people have seen it. Some haven't. So for those that have not been in that world, give us a little bit of like, what are the distinctives of this world that you grew up in for 20 years? What don't we understand about that world?
Okay. So yeah, so IFB would be an umbrella above the Bill Gothard Shiny Happy People level. So I was adjacent, I was under that umbrella, but I was adjacent to the Bill Gothard materials that were shown in the Shiny Happy People. I went to Bill Gothard's training. I remember the first time I went to one, it was the day I got the first time I ever had a hot sub at Subway. So it's funny how things stick in your mind.
Yes,
but I remember
yes.
The Bill Gothard books on the shelf. My parents fully ascribed to it. I'm so thankful after having watched, I haven't finished Shiny Happy People, but as far as I have gotten, I've seen there's a homeschool curriculum they used, and I'm so thankful my parents didn't use that. I have friends that went way deeper into it. I could relate a lot. I've read Jill and her sister's memoirs from last year. I related a lot to the content. So just in general, IFB is a super high control religion. I would call it a cult. In fact, in my book, I call it a cult because it checks a lot of the boxes of a cult in that every pastor, it's almost like an imam in Islam or like the, I can't remember the name in the Amish faith, but there's like one elder who his word says what the Bible means to his whole community. And it goes way beyond what we would consider theological or appropriate context for church to very minute things in your daily life, like whether or not you can wear closed-toed shoes or open-toed shoes. And I mean, just incredible stuff. And so it's one man's word in each congregation against everybody else's, which obviously opens itself up to abuse. It's why abuse is so rampant there. But they're proud to be called fundamentalists. I remember the first time when I saw after September 11th, the word fundamentalist applied to the people who attacked us on 9/11 is going, well, that's not fair. but in many ways, and in my book, I make a lot of the connections of how similar we were to the Islamic fundamentalists. And so, yeah, the IBLP, the Bill Gothard wing, was another version of it underneath the same umbrella. But none of the pastors were accountable to any other pastor, to a denomination. We all had Baptists on the sign, but there was nobody checking in on us, right? That was the only reality we knew. And that's one of the things you see in Shiny Happy People. It's really good at isolating. That independent is so huge because it isolates you to where you have no idea what a thriving faith is outside of that movement.
Right. So if people hear the word Baptist, if somebody's hearing about the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, the IFB would consider the SBC—
Oh, flaming liberals.
Not—
To tell you how much that's true. So I live now about 15 minutes from Liberty University. Just so happened I moved here. I never attended there or anything like that. But when we had people transfer from Liberty to our college, it was as if they got saved. When you consider Jerry Falwell as liberal, it can kind of tell you how conservative we were in our faith.
I love that you are speaking about this because you're not speaking as an outsider. You actually lived this for 2 decades of your life. This is your native language. This is the water that you grew up swimming in. And so I'm going to like just go right into sort of what happened here. Like after 2 decades, something happened. What happened? What happened next?
Well, actually, before the revelations that I think you're getting to, I didn't actually learn those until a decade outside of the cult. Okay. But what first happened was my wife did not grow up fundamentalist. And when we got married, I forced her into a fundamentalist IFB church. And after 2.5 years, she was just dead inside on Sundays. And I said, tell you what, when we moved to Virginia, which is a big change, I'll let you have the leading vote on where we go to church. And she grew up in South America in a missionary family. And so she picked a Spanish-speaking congregation. And that opened up for me church culture. I said, well, of course, they're from different countries. Of course, they do church differently. And so that started to crack in me to go, oh, no, there's different ways to do church. There's different ways to read this. We had people from 14 different countries in our church. And at the end of that, I was struggling spiritually because I wasn't catching the community, right? I was the outsider. And so my wife said, well, why don't you find the next church and we'll work on it. And so that's when I found the church where I've been going the last 18 years next week.
Wow, 18 years.
And my wife's on staff there now and I serve there every Sunday. So
that says a lot that you're writing a book that points out some really hard things that have happened in the name of Christianity, but you are still in a church. So if someone has to say, well, Ryan George is just trying to destroy the church, I would say, but he's been in his church for 18 years.
Yeah, I'm super Christian. I've been baptized into 3 different faiths. I was christened a Catholic. I was dunked in IFB Baptist. And then when I had a transformation of my soul and really started following Jesus when I was 29, I got baptized again. So I'm triple dunked.
You have said so many things that have made me think, well, that made a huge difference in your life. Like the fact that you even listened to your wife say, hey, I feel a little uncomfortable with this, doesn't feel really natural with the IFB upbringing. Isn't the husband supposed to make that decision?
I wanted my wife to be happy. She'd made a lot of sacrifices. She grew up in the mountains of Bolivia. And I had moved her to the middle. Literally, our townhouse was in the middle of 2 cornfields in Indiana. There was not a single person of color in our church that I can remember. There was no, a lot of her cultural proclivities couldn't be met, you know? Now we live in the mountains again. Obviously not the mountains of Bolivia, but the Blue Ridge Mountains are a good proxy for that. And we live close enough to the beach that she can scratch that itch. I knew stuff about my dad. I didn't know what I know now to know that he was a hypocrite. I knew that what I grew up in, there was already some cracks starting to realize that what I grew up in wasn't the real thing. And so I was just open. The other thing, this sounds really funny, but the first book I wrote in 2004, I started it the first year of marriage. We didn't have a TV and I had a typewriter and a laptop from work. And so I started working. And as I tried to write a book and tried to find what I believe in there, as I'm searching the scriptures, I couldn't find what I believed in there because it wasn't in there. It was all this stuff that I was taught for 20 years was in there. And so actually writing my first book made me more open. I talked to Crystal. She says, well, of course that's not in there. That's not what the Bible says.
She hadn't grown up in that.
And she's a truth teller. So the college I went to started a seminary while we were there. And I don't know how much you know about seminaries, but you have to have a foundational differentiation topic that your seminary is known for, whatever. You know. Yeah. And so our colleges, when it started on the KJV only issue. So our college was further right than Bob Jones University. In fact, we used to watch videos on campus about how liberal Bob Jones University, this gives you a context.
Wow.
And she went to the president of the seminary in his office and pinned him against the wall with all the ways he was wrong and then walked out while he was speechless. So she's always been a truth teller that way. And on our first date, it was a blind date. I asked her, if you came with a warning label, what would it be? And she said, be real with me. And that's been the catalyst of so many things in our marriage to go, hey, this is what I'm really feeling and thinking. This is what I'm wrestling with. So yeah, she was a huge part of that transformation for me.
I love that. Yeah. So you already had a little bit of different distance between you and the IFB church because of getting married and your wife introducing you to different things. And then you found out your dad was a bigger hypocrite than you could have ever imagined. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my dad actually performed our wedding ceremony because he was ordained. And then 2 years later, he told right before we left Indiana that he had cheated on my mom with a 19-year-old. And I was probably 22, 23 at the time. So here he was cheating on someone the age of my siblings, literally one of my sister's good friends. And that started to break it. And then a few years later, my wife, because she's bilingual, she does translation work. She's now the missions director at our church. She does a lot of trips to Nicaragua to help women who are coming out of the sex trafficking trade. And so what she does, she takes counselors and therapists from up here down there, but she also takes women of our church who feel like their story could help. And she does training to say, hey, if something like this has happened, if this could be a triggering thing for you, we want to talk about it now before we leave. And in one of those pre-trip plannings, one of my good friends who I'd grown up with admitted that my dad had molested her on multiple occasions. And yeah, that wasn't fun to learn. I talk about how I learned that in the book. And then she actually asked me to go with her to confront my dad. And then 6 Christmases later, my wife's a trained artist. She was painting in my parents' living room, and she overheard my dad talking to some kids that had visited. And my parents have a very open door policy. There's all kinds of people in our house.
Yeah.
But she heard my dad talking to some middle schoolers about how the women in Song of Solomon were praised for their body parts. And just like ripped out her earbuds, was like, wait, no, what? And we reported to their parents, but their parents didn't know all the other stuff we knew, right? These are girls that hang out at Pastor George's house. And so they didn't have the background to believe us. And then about 2 years after that, maybe 3 years, 2 years after that, a podcast came out with one of my dad's victims who had receipts. It's almost a 2-hour long interview. And she gave a whole bunch of details. Well, turns out she was the quote unquote 19-year-old that my dad had claimed to have an affair. It was not consensual, and it started before she was an adult. And the most damning thing on that whole thing, I mean, there's all kinds of damning information on there, but when they took it to my mom, this would have been in early 2000s, the witnesses heard my mom say, oh, not again. And so that left a whole lot of questions. We moved a lot when I was a kid. We moved in situations that just didn't make sense. Like at one point in our Christian school, my parents were half of our school teachers. And we just left in the middle of a school day in November and moved away. And the church and some affiliated churches paid my dad going away money for 18 months to get another church started in another state. There was a time the IFB faith is really big in door-to-door visitation, like the Jehovah's Witness. Mm-hmm. And we lived on an island in the Chesapeake Bay. And I remember going door-to-door visitation with my mom one time. We came to a house and we asked the lady, hey, do you have a faith? Do you have a church? We'd love to invite you to ours. And she said, what church do you go to? And we told her, and she said, oh, I would never go there. The pastor there is having an affair. And my mom, standing right next to me to my left, I remember where it was. There's a Cracker Barrel right there now. She goes, no, he's not. He's my husband. I would know. And the lady, I've never met her before. My mom's never met her before. The lady on the other side of the door goes, oh, ma'am, you don't know your husband. I had no context for that because that was before I learned any of this stuff.
I want to piggyback on that just a little bit. You know, unfortunately, we keep having news of pastors, ministry leaders doing really stupid things, sometimes criminal, abusive things. Sometimes they are in the news and people speculate. I would love to have you speak into, as a family member of an abuser, how it is that you don't know. You don't see. How would you explain that to someone that's like, of course you knew, Ryan. Of course you knew. But I would argue maybe not.
In fact, so when the podcast came out in 2021 with the one victim, she actually said on air, and it's still on YouTube if you go find it, she said that I must have been covering for my dad because I had to have known. And I'm embarrassed that I never even put those two together. One of the things that helped me was I started reading about 30 to 50, sometimes 60 nonfiction books a year. And obviously I've started reading a lot about trauma and abuse because of getting into therapy and stuff, trying to figure out my own situation. And now I have language for it. And now I can put pieces together so easily. I think one of the things that protects these pastors is they use theology to their advantage to twist things, to make you not think that what you're seeing is reality. And so even family, my mom had to find out from someone on the other side, my mom, the one who sleeps with this guy, bore him six kids, like should know my dad better than anybody, found out from a stranger through a screen door that her husband was having an affair. It's such a wild thing.
If people say, well, she must have been complicit, I want to argue and say you don't understand abuse dynamics.
And my dad was good at hiding. And they don't look untrustworthy, right? Because they're the man of God or they're the teacher or the preacher or whatever. But one of the victims, I talked to her attorneys. I say, hey, I'll help whatever. I have no problem putting my dad behind bars. I'll help whatever. And he said, your dad was so slick in how he covered his tracks. I was like, yeah, I totally didn't see it. I have no idea how you pull off, especially as tired as my dad was, you know, homeschooling five kids at a time. He worked a day job. He was bivocational. I don't even know how he had time to do all of this stuff. And I think that's part of it. Like in your mind, you go, when would dad have had time to do any of that? We didn't have any money. You know, we live below the poverty line. How was he affording a double life?
Yeah.
Those were questions we didn't ask then because it just, I couldn't have figured out. I couldn't have given my dad a 20-minute window to pull off anything like that, let alone hours of time to do it.
Right. And abuse only works because the abuser isn't 100% evil 100% of the time. If that was the case, we would all easily spot it.
48 hours before my book, like the final version went to print, I had to take out a guy that I look up to because it came out that he was covering for a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm kind of with you. I have people I admire, but I try not to have heroes anymore.
Yeah. So if someone comes up to you and says, hey, Ryan, this person you say is so awesome, I need to tell you, maybe they're not. How do you respond when somebody tells you something like that?
Well, now I believe them. Nothing is shocked. There's a few people left on my list that I would be shocked if Scott McKnight or Bob Goff or a couple of these other people that I look up to that I've had very human connections. But overall, I'm not surprised. And part of it is because I've seen it not just in IFB churches, right? I go to a non-denominational church and I've had to report two sex offenders in my church. I've seen affairs and whatever else of people who've, I've watched them get baptized, right? Like, I think it's part of the human condition. Yeah, so I'm with you on that. I would accept that. I remember the first time I read about Bill Hybels and Ravi Zacharias, and it didn't take me long to convince me of what they had done. It also didn't surprise me that their families had no idea. Yeah, and I live in Falwellville, right? I know Jerry Jr.'s next door neighbor. He and I used to run together. Several of these different people, it does not shock me at all. All this stuff with Mars Hill, it was riveting, but it was not surprising at all based on the sermons that people shared with me. Anybody who preaches with anger, I go, there's something, that boiler is going to burst at some point. Their insecurity is showing. So I lead an outdoor men's ministry. We study the Bible and do discipleship prayer. Sometimes we do service projects together. But one of the key elements is as much as possible, unless the elements are really bad, we meet outside. So tonight it's going to be 40 degrees here. We're going to be meeting outside around the fire. But where we meet around the fire is a public park so that there's plenty of parking for everybody. And I would say 50% of the Wednesday nights when we meet there, somebody goes by in a lifted truck and drops the clutch and makes this loud exhaust noise. It's showing off their insecurity, right?
Why do you need to do that?
Right. Yeah, and I know that because one of the things that I've learned in counseling is all the things I was doing out of insecurity. My whole last book, you can read about the things I learned by journeying into my own insecurity. And so when I see some of these pastors now, I have the same response as to those trucks going by of going, oh, they are utterly insecure and they have to do this to feel like a man and the way that they define manhood. I wish they knew how obvious it was to the rest of us that this is all a play for them to feel better about themselves.
That's a perfect segue to the next question I have for you, Ryan.
I didn't even know.
You set me up perfectly. Speaking of that, when people are in the middle of being deceived, I'm thinking of all the people you grew up with in IFB, maybe even some family members that are still in that. Mm-hmm. People are thinking of people that they know that are in really unhealthy, high control groups, and they are like, how can I rescue them? Can I rescue them? And does it work for me to just go and say, hey, Ryan, you do realize you're in a cult, right? Does that work?
I've not seen that approach work.
Tell me
more. It took me 20 years outside the cult before I was willing to call it a cult. So obviously, if you had come up to me in 2002, which is my last year in it, and said, hey, you're in a cult, you need to get out, I don't know that I would have believed you. So I have been able to get a few of my siblings out. I have family members who are still in it. It isn't possible for everybody, but the way I've done it is the way I found Jesus was finding a Jesus that loved me, that I loved, like a winsome Jesus, a Jesus like, I want that Jesus. You know, one of the lines in my book is, have you ever seen a happy dictator? You might see him laugh over a cigar, but you don't see a happy dictator, right? Or even the wannabe dictators, like some of our current politicians. And so what I found was I can love people out. And my parents knew that was dangerous. So because we're homeschooled, we didn't get senior trips like regular high schoolers did. And right about the time my second set of siblings started graduating, there's like a gap in us kids. And when the second set, I had disposable income and a lot of airline miles. And I started pitching to my siblings, hey, I'll take you anywhere in the world you want for your senior trip. And my parents were so scared of that. I did a proposal for my brother, who's 13 years younger than me. And we lived in Queenstown, Maryland. I said, let's go to Queenstown, New Zealand. We'll bungee jump, skydive, base jump. We'll do all the crazy stuff. And my parents weren't scared of that. My dad said the hardest yes we had was that we were going to let him be around you for 2 weeks. Because wow. I hadn't even fully left the IFB faith. I wasn't even yet, when I proposed that, I wasn't even going to the church I was going to now. By the time we traveled, I was. But they had already seen I was already on the way out. And they're like, we know if you're this effusive with love with your brother and giving him an experience that we don't give him, that you'll have his heart. And it's the same with my sisters. Mm-hmm. I let them live with me when they got out of college. My dad said, hey, you can live the first 6 months at our house for free. After that, you got to pay rent. I was out in 2 weeks, but my siblings, I was like, hey, my house, you're welcome. No rent until you get on your feet.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for the people that I've seen leave it, they left for love, right? I left because I loved a woman who showed me a Jesus I didn't even know and introduced me to cultures that I didn't know. What I have found is the only way out is to love people, because what they're going to do is they're going to go, I feel love here. And so many people get trapped, particularly in IFB, but definitely high pressure religion, high control religion, because they feel if I leave here, I lose everything. And there is shunning, right? And I've seen that happen. I have friends that that's happened. And so if you can say, no, if you leave here, you will be safe in my embrace. You'll be safe in my home. You'll be safe in my car. I'll take you on vacation. Not to bribe, but to give them a life that they've never had inside.
One of the things I see in your book, and even as you are talking with me, is that you realize that you have gone on a journey. I hate the word journey. With your understanding of abuse, what it looks like, how it acts, like some things that we used to talk about as affairs were not. Mm-hmm. They were abuse. So I'd love to hear you talk about, like, what do you know now? What do you understand now about like abuse, physical, sexual abuse, and spiritual abuse that you didn't get back then?
Oh, wow. Yeah, as a category, just that it's even a category. I was having a conversation with one of my IFB buddies. We grew up together. And he got an advanced copy of my book, was reading it, and called me. He's like, man, I don't think you're smart to put this out. I don't agree with you putting this book out and revealing all this stuff. And he was talking. I said, yeah, but dude, my dad hung me in high school. My dad put me out in minus 30 degree Fahrenheit weather to quote unquote cool me off. My dad threw me through a wall, beat me, all kinds of stuff. And I said, we didn't call that abuse. We called that creative parenting back then. I was like, part of it is getting the labels to realize that that's not normal. For me to tell a story in a group of guys and people to like, for their jaws to drop, I'm like, wait, what? You weren't allowed to walk on the same sidewalk as a girl at your college? Like that, just some of it going, what you experienced was not normal, starts to shake it up, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Part of that is reading, I mean, great books. And then becoming a dad. So I tried not to be a dad. I had all three versions of a vasectomy, make sure I wouldn't create one biologically. I was on a helicopter expedition up in Canada. I get back. Civilization, I get a text from my wife saying, oh, by the way, there's a young lady living with us. Boom, you're a dad. And now she's my legal daughter. We have adopted her.
Mm-hmm.
And going, I wouldn't do that with my daughter. Now, I remember one time, it may have been the last time my mom was ever in my house. It was years ago. My daughter gives back to me. Like if I'm saying something, she's like, well, that's a hot take. And so my daughter and I will just sit there and have that conversation. Whereas a kid, my dad would have got mad. I would have had a fist in my face. I would have been thrown somewhere, you know. And my mom stops in her tracks and she looks at me and she says, you let your kid talk to you like that? I was like, yeah, my kid loves me and I love my kid. And this is a fun conversation.
Yeah.
And a lot of times my daughter is right and I'm better for it.
This is secure attachment.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, that's the official term.
Yes.
But so part of it was becoming a dad. Part of it was the things that I was told about women and then marrying an amazing woman and going, well, I wouldn't want to treat my wife that way. That doesn't make sense. Why would I do that to somebody I love? you know, and she's a better shepherd of souls than I am. Why would I discount what she's doing for the kingdom when she's doing it way better than I probably ever will? And so part of it was just in relationship going, man, this doesn't make sense with what I was told.
Some people are afraid when they see that. Their brain shuts down because it says, danger, don't look there, don't go there. So you've seen a lot of crap. But you said, as we started our conversation, you've been in your church for 18 years. Mm-hmm. What keeps you in an organized church and not just like peace out?
I don't know that I'm into church as like the Christian industrial complex. And I don't think my church has some special answer. In fact, last week I spent an hour on the phone with my pastor disagreeing with him on a major topic that's in my book. And we both agreed to disagree. I mean, he's cool. He's an elder in my church. And he goes, nah, that's not where we land on. And he said, but I respect how you got there. So, but part of it for me is church for me isn't only Sunday, and church for me isn't only the church I attend. I consider what I'm doing tonight, which is a parachurch thing. There's guys from 4 to 6 different churches, depending on the night that'll be there. We have church. I've had church without a building most of the time. In fact, at our church, we don't call the building church. We call it the building. We don't call it a sanctuary. We call it the big room. And those are intentional decisions that we make in a Bible Belt town to go, no, church is not the gathering. Church is not the LLC or the, you know, the 501c3 or whatever. Church is the community of souls. And that can happen in any number of sizes and groups and environments. But for me, the biggest positive changes in my life and the most intimate moments of my life have come with people of faith who have an attractive Jesus. They have the Jesus that we were promised. They had the Jesus that people flocked to in the New Testament. We had the Jesus that people would cry on his feet, right? I've cried on Jesus's feet so many times. Mm. So church is just where I go to hang out with other people who have the same opinion. I mean, it could be any number of things. And so I don't know that I have a lot of hope for the American church, particularly right now, how it's aligned politically and a lot of the violent stuff that it's doing. All the abuse. I follow the Roy's report. I support them monthly. I follow a bunch of Instagram accounts that show what's wrong with the church. And I believe all of it.
Yeah.
But I also know that that's the malignant, unorthodox version of what Jesus designed. And so if I'm connected to Jesus, then I'm going to naturally want to be connected to other people who are connected to Jesus. And we're going to disagree. I disagree with my wife on theological stuff, on practical things. But we can both be in ministry and we can both do things because we go, yeah, but I recognize the Jesus in you. And so I can agree with that.
I think that might be one of the secrets to surviving with our faith is not tying our faith to a local church so much or a denomination. You've seen the real thing. You've seen the real Jesus.
I got asked last week on another podcast, what do I tell people who have left the church who are out? They've deconstructed. They're trying to figure out if they're going to reconstruct like I did or like some other people have. And maybe this is not popular, but I don't tell them to go back to church yet. It's like, find whatever way you need to fall in love with Jesus and to start hearing directly from him. There's a pastor out in California, Irwin McManus, who says it this way. He said, when you say yes to Jesus, his voice becomes louder and clearer. And as you say no, it becomes less discernible. And I think about it several years ago, I got really into whitewater kayaking and I had a friend, Johnny, who would invite me all the time. He's like my mentor, teaching me how to do everything. And I was also going through a transition in my business and he would text me once every week or two. He's like, hey, I'm going to the river today. Can you go? And over time, as I'm working more and more, I say, hey, Johnny, I can't go, man. I can't go today. And eventually, like 2 months, 3 months later, he just stopped calling. Not because we're not friends anymore. Not because I don't like kayaking. I kept saying no. And so I lost that relationship with Johnny on the river anyway. And I think Jesus is that way. Not again, out of spite. He's just going, hey, I've asked you 12 times. You said, no, I'm going to ask somebody on the river who's going to say yes.
Yeah. He's not going to force you.
And so if you can connect with the source, then eventually, so if I connect again with Johnny, when I go, well, who's also at the river, his other buddies. Right. And so now there's 6 of us going down the river together. That's in that parallel. It's church. Right. And so eventually when you fall back in love with Jesus, you will be drawn to other people who are in love with the same. You don't go to a Taylor Swift concert alone, right? All those people who are in love with Taylor Swift, they're paying hundreds of dollars to hang out with other people who love Taylor Swift. They make friends, you know, like people become friends overnight at these concerts.
Yeah. You may drive there alone, but you
don't leave there alone.
Have a friend.
It's the same with church, right? My Taylor Swift is Jesus. And I show up, and whether it's a stadium or whether it's a creek or a river. And part of that too is the spiritual pathways. Depending on which framework you use, it's 7 to 9 different vertical love languages, how we feel and express love to God. Depending on which framework you use, I'm typically my number one is the outdoors. I sense God most out in nature, which is why my Bible study group's outside. It's why I discipled a guy while hiking 5 miles before dawn this morning. That's my pathway. And so that's not my wife's, right? So when I'm reconstructing or figuring something out in my faith, I go outside. And almost all my praying is outside. I hardly ever pray indoors.
Yeah.
And so it's just finding which way you feel closest to Him. Pursue that. And then eventually other people, the guy hiking with me this morning loves Jesus, loves the outdoors, right? Like that, the church draws itself together.
What is your biggest hope as you are bringing your book into the world?
Oh, wow. I have lots of dreams, but I hope it gives people the courage to go to counseling. I hope it gives people courage to tell their story. And maybe counseling is the only place they feel safe to do that now. I hope it gives people courage to admit that what they had was not right, to be able to call abuse abuse. And more than anything, I hope people fall in love with the winsome Jesus. I hope they see the Jesus I have. One of my friends grew up in the same cult I did, went to the same college I did, whatever, completely walked like godless man. And he saw some of the promo I'm doing on my Facebook page. And he said, I would not read this book unless you wrote it. And I will read it because you did, because you're living the life that proves the stuff works, right? And that's what I hope I can do to people, to be like, there's hope. I have a bunch of friends who have not rebuilt their faith. They've only deconstructed. They have not reconstructed. And what I'm hoping to do is show them there is a pathway to making something beautiful out of it without throwing it all away.
Yeah. Yes, I find you to be a compassionate guide. I did feel like this isn't somebody trying to talk me into anything. This isn't somebody that is like anxiously out there worried about where I am and what I'm doing. You're saying, hey, the water's good over here. I'd love to have you join me over here.
Well, and some of the, if you didn't like it over there, from IFB survivors, from other church abuse people, they're telling their stories really soon after finding a new church. I thought Ginger Duggar's book, that's where one of the major criticisms I have, she left that and went into a cult where a guy is, the church that she bragged on in her book is very caustic. So one of the benefits is for me to say, hey guys, I've been out for almost 2 decades. I'm discipling other people. I've got a lot of practice of doing this with other people. I earn these stripes. I've fleshed this out with counselors, with pastors, with theologians. I'm not trying to sell a book. I'm not trying to be famous. I'm ready to go back to a quiet life. But if I can give someone permission, it's interesting. My last book, I wrote about all these adventures and what I learned about God, scaring myself. And the feedback I got most from people, that wasn't that they went and took a course how to jump out of a plane or that they tried another. You know, the number one feedback I got was, you gave me the courage to be vulnerable with somebody else. And that was not why I wrote that book, but man, if you put that on my legacy, if that's in my eulogy someday, that I gave the courage to somebody to be vulnerable, heck yeah, I'll sign up for that every time.
I love that. Well, I've loved having this conversation with you. Thank you so much for stopping by the podcast. I'm looking forward to the world getting to learn a little bit more about your story and picking up your book. So thank you so much for Ryan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I kept talking with Ryan for the Patreon community, so don't forget to check that out if you are a member. If you aren't, you can sign up at patreon.com/untangledfaith, and I'll have a link for you in the show notes. And while you're checking out those show notes, that's also the place where you can find a link to Ryan's new book that releases soon, as well as some other episodes I think you might like. If you're on social media, I'd love to keep this conversation going over on Threads, or you can chat with us on Instagram or through the Facebook page. I'm Untangled Faith on Instagram and Facebook, and I'm Amy Henning Fritz on Threads. The Untangled Faith podcast is hosted and edited by me, Amy Fritz. This podcast is made possible by the support of my Patreon community. A special thanks to my producers who help make all of this possible. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next week.